Hello, welcome to the Mondays on Tuesdays podcast, where we talk about how nothing happens when you think it does. I'm very excited about the podcast today. I'm a little bit nervous because I have so many things to weave together. I was listening to the podcast from last week, and it seemed to be okay in terms of how things blended. It covered all kinds of things at once. And the subject today, I'll get into the Compare Basic podcast, which happens for the first 5 minutes in a second, but the subject today focuses mainly on cryptography. I have a great story from World War II that has to do with a time when they actually read 10,000 Leagues Under the Sea to securely and secretly communicate bombing locations to the Allied forces. And the next topic is this idea of conventions and the role that sort of misplaced conventions play in not adopting things. And I hope I can go a bit into sort of my perspective on sort of the resume as a convention and a format. And then the other subject that I did really want to talk about is just conventions themselves. You know, why is it that we feel like things that don't necessarily serve us should be continued, or the other side of it is dumping traditions that do serve us and we don't do them. Things like, you know, having a regular schedule, working with your, you know, circadian rhythm and getting a good cadence and eating nutritiously and exercising and spending time with friends and, you know, observing, you know, honesty and good product metrics and a lot of traditions that have kind of fallen apart. And so, as is true to form here on Mondays on Tuesday, I'm going to talk a bit about my company, Compare Basic, for until the 5 minute mark. So if that's not your jam, feel free to skip to when the music starts. It should be exactly 5 minutes. So the last update I gave was that I had gotten started on the cryptography library, and that was true, and it performs, and there's something I'll talk about sort of later on I call phrase key. What inevitably happened, actually, was instead of this week being finishing up the cryptography layer and putting it into the web server, I found out that the way I was thinking about saving data and moving data around was not as effective as it could have been. So it's been more or less a week of cleaning up and re-implementing what I had referred to as the stream system is now just called the buffer system. And it's really interesting what actually happened from me sort of modeling this space. You can think of my original perspective as this is a train station. And when I save something to disk that way, it's one train departing. And when I, you know, read it from disk into memory, it's that train arriving. While at any given time, I have one thing to do, I can consider myself as kind of like being in one train station. The application itself is more like a network of train stations. And some of those trains that start on one track are actually the same train that arrive on the other track going the other direction. The analogy for this is like, if I generate a piece of data in memory and then save it to disk, or read something from disk and then do something with it in memory and then update it back on disk, I used to think of these as a whole bunch of different arrivals and departures. And what I found out is that I actually wanted to basically, you know, to extend the analogy, send a train somewhere, bring it back, change it, and send that same train somewhere else. So that takes me to the next subject of cryptography, which is asymmetric keys use very large numbers that look very much like the output of a hash function. And that hash function can take any amount of text, a paragraph of your favorite book. You know, you could put an entire novel in there if you want. And that's something that does have a personal connection to you. And so it is entirely possible to go from passphrase through something like SHA-256 or SHA-512 and then into asymmetric cryptographic keys, such as elliptic keys or RSA keys if you have a system that still needs to use them. We have this same idea that what we didn't write ourselves is out of our control. If it was a certificate based on a random number, it's not ours. It was, you know, generated by the computer. We don't really understand it. And that's why phrase key, which connects sort of, you know, a paragraph the size of, you know, a chapter of your favorite book. Why is it that we have sophisticated conventions that have not yet really been applied where I believe they could be? And I'm hoping I can talk about it in a mostly non-technical, non-mathematical way. So to come full circle on why I'm explaining pre-image resistant hashing and summaries and why you can't go back, it's because that defines the difference between presenting authority that you can verify versus authority you can copy. And so when you log into a website, it throws it through this hashing function that gives it an idea that you in fact derived that hashing from the value they expect, which is your password. And they can save that without saving your password. This is great if you are there to type in your password. And it's not so great if you need your email to check in the background. You know, you gotta know if you have an email, you're not there to type your password every time you change. This concept of passwords being a problem is because not only are passwords annoying, but they don't go beyond a space where something has to authenticate based on you giving it credentials ahead of time. So OAuth is a way where you log into a server and that server does not give your original password. It gives an authenticity token. And then that token is used by the recipient to go back to the server to figure out your authenticity over time. And so there's a solution to this idea of not saving the password called asymmetric cryptic keys. And it's asymmetric. Asym means, you know, they don't, the two pieces don't line up. And this is what you see used in, you know, HTTPS. Originally, it was a technology called RSA, which was prime number based. Now, the most commonly used is called elliptic curve, which is a similar mechanism in terms of how it's used, just a different way of using uniqueness. And the thing about asymmetric keys is they're just strangely large numbers, and where do you store them? Do you have them on a USB key? If you move it from a USB key to a computer, is that a safe place to put it? If you have it on a server, is that a safe place to put it? And so there's just no real good solution to the sort of feeling of safety of a password that only you can type in. And I realize that this may be the missing piece to personalizing the use of asymmetric keys. And if you think that the chapter of your favorite book is not unique enough, consider the idea that security is not actually absolute. It's a matter of the threshold. It's a matter of, you know, is the key you use to your front door significantly uncopyable? And at a time, they weren't. And people started using those keys with the little like ring holes in them and things that are harder to copy. You can't go to any store. And so there are mechanisms for upgrading the security when it's necessary. And security always is a balance of practicality and convenience. And I want to talk about a Netflix show that I really, really liked. It was called All the Light We Cannot See. And it's about a young radio technician who gets recruited by the Nazis and a broadcaster in France. And she's reading chapters from 10,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And the reason she's doing this is because she and her father are out surveying where the military bases are so that the Allied forces can come bomb them with the precision to minimize civilian casualties. And what this is an example of is that the Allied forces have a copy of 10,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and they have mapped the chapter and phrase to various coordinates on the island. And so she tells a story about why she's, and she's not reading in order, she's reading it randomly, jumping here, jumping there. And she reads it as a communication of where there is a military base. And this is actually a true story. I very much encourage you to watch the Netflix series. It was also a book that I hear is rather fantastic. And this, to me, is a much cleaner and clearer model of what cryptography is. It's basically just something you have that's secretive that you can communicate through sort of saying something that everyone in public can hear, but they won't be able to get the meaning of it. So I want to talk a little bit about, I've talked about the sort of password to a hash that doesn't get saved so that authority cannot be represented. I want to talk about what an elliptic key actually is, because for a very long time, it was so strange to me. So the idea is that you have a public key that you can send around, and nobody can figure out what your private key is based on that. And you can sign things. You can create some random piece of data that indicates that you, in fact, are publishing what you're publishing. You, in fact, signed this document. You, in fact, have, you know, released this software. And people can verify that your signature is real without having your private key, only having this public key. I mean, this is the weirdest thing. This is like, how do you have the ability to verify something that you don't have? And so I did some research, and I'm not a mathematician, but what I have come up with is more or less that the best way that I can think about it is that if I were to come up with a length on some very, very large yardstick, and only I knew what the length of this yardstick was, and then I took a bag of Scrabble letters, and everybody knew what the Scrabble letters were, but nobody knew which one I had grabbed. And I grab my Scrabble letter, and I add the value of this Scrabble letter to my yardstick. That's my public key. And I say, oh, hey, you know, this is how you authenticate something. Now, I take my yardstick to sign something or to decrypt something that someone has sent to me, and I position it, and when they encode it with my yardstick plus the Scrabble letter, they have no way of knowing where the Scrabble letter ends and where my yardstick begins. Kind of like if you take any number in the range of 100 and you say, well, my secret number added with some other random number in the range of 100 is 72. Nobody would know if your number was 10, if your number was 30, and the other number was a randomly chosen number within that range. And so you have this idea of people can see something that you're showing them, but only you know the secret component of what you're showing them. And so you share this yardstick plus the Scrabble letter, and they encrypt stuff with it, and I'm not exactly sure what the math is on that, or they verify the signature of something. And when it comes back to you, because you know what the original yardstick was, you can generate another signature. You can then decrypt what has been sent to you. And the encryption method is really interesting. I like to think of it as when I give my public key to someone, I'm kind of giving them like a fancy piece of tape. And this fancy piece of tape allows people to put things in boxes and then seal it with my fancy piece of tape in a way that they can't even unseal it. There's some, I don't know, maybe metaphorically, there's something in the glue that you can't melt or something like that. And so when the box comes back to me, because I know what the sort of yardstick value was, what the secret component of that public key was, I and only I can decrypt that data and open the box. And so the way that SSH and HTTPS works uses this public key. However, I'm not going to go into that because HTTPS and TLS in general has this really crazy negotiation process of making keys and all this kind of stuff. And I can't help but wonder if this was all done for a time when devices could not make their own keys, when it was important to negotiate the generation of a key with a server that had the cryptographic libraries that were more sufficient than the client. And that's just not the case anymore. Phones have the ability to generate keys because browsers have the ability to generate keys in the crypto library that now ships with almost all HTML5 capable browsers, which is almost all common browsers. And so we live in a world where it's entirely possible to publish a public key as a DNS record, or start a conversation with the distribution of a public key. And the entire TLS guesswork process could be simplified and for the most part eliminated if I basically, you know, sent a server my fancy roll of tape, they put some stuff in a box, seal it up, send it back to me. Within that contents, they send their, you know, roll of tape for me to package my own box that I send back to them. Or they could, you know, what eventually happens, because there's a way of doing things faster called HMAC. Eventually, once SSL certificates, cryptographic certificates of an asymmetric nature are established between the server and the client, they just send an HMAC key because it's faster anyway. An HMAC key is symmetrical and has the impersonation issue, but at this point in time, the server and the client are talking the same language in the same way, and so it's not as much of an issue. And so what I'm hoping is that using this phrase key method, people can use large paragraphs that they can remember. And if you establish it on a server, you don't even have to download your key because you have something on your phone where you can establish that same key by taking this piece of text as the source, and the hashing and then generation of the asymmetric key is all predictable. And so it completely eliminates the need to worry about where you're storing things. And you even could just send a server your public key and not even worry about that. And that comes down to the idea of convention and where is it valuable and where is it not. And passwords are so much a part of what we like that we don't want that to be disrupted. And people talk all the time about don't reinvent the wheel. I hear that absolutely all the time. And I like to talk about wheels for a minute because the original wheel was made of wood. And wheels now are rubberized and pressurized, and they have fancy rims and ball bearings, and there are all kinds of inventions. And the wheel has, in fact, been reinvented a number of times. But I think what's really important here is the perspective on when to reinvent something and when not to. I talked early in the podcast about how I had reinvented my input-output layer because I had a misconception of whether or not the trains were single destination trains or were in fact going to loop around and switch direction. And changing that model made the code that I'm writing far more efficient, far more effective at a time when I really need it, which is when I have consumer demands to build things. And so I think the phrase reinventing the wheel comes down to two things. It's not just whether or not it's valuable to reinvent something. It's whether or not that reinvention will disrupt something that someone relies on. And speaking of disrupting something that someone relies on, I'd like to talk a bit about the resume format. So I like to think of a resume as kind of like the key you provide to get a job in a way. It's the authentication and authorization that you can in fact do the work. And to the extent that it is accurate or not is somewhat debatable. But what I'd like to focus on is that it has kind of become an irrational form of representation for the modern workplace. And I'll give a few examples. So resume is a historical document that says where you've been for how long, what title you have, and some of the accomplishments you've had there. And my question is, what should someone do if they had a day job working in restaurants for 2 days while they were working as a sustainable gardening landscape coordinator and also, making videos as a freelancer while driving part-time for delivery service? What if that all happened in 1 year, and given the gig economy that we have, that's not uncommon? How would you list that? Would it be like a grid format? you have like all these little boxes and the people, because what that's going to communicate to an employer is just this person's difficult and hard to understand and we don't want to hire them. And I think the idea that the resume format is not a reflection of the modern workplace is not something I have to spend a whole lot of time convincing people of. I did hear a story about a company that had a policy of not hiring anyone who had less than a year chunk of time on their resume. And they then hired about 100 people and laid them off after 6 months. And so they had made their own employees unhireable under their own conditions. But I think that essentially the resume is kind of like a promissory note in that people defend it not necessarily because they believe in it itself, but because they are in fact building their own resume. You know, they're going to work every day thinking about the time that they can go home as soon as they walk in the door and feeling like, well, you know what? I got to stay here a year or more for the resume. And as sad as this sounds, that has the same transactional value as a dollar bill that I know I can spend at any store where I need to spend it. And if we consider that we are investing in the steps we take today because of some expected future value, we will be wholly unable to change a convention that we ourselves are relying on for that value. And so the solution that I have to this is what I call the skills doc, which is something I'm working on with Compare Basic as part of sort of the Seriously Human, which is the employment chapter of the company. And the concept is basically to have a document that answers the question, can you do this job? Not from a perspective of only time. Time is a valuable thing. I mean, you know, if you haven't spent very much time on something, there are things that will not have occurred to you. But what I would love to have is a skills document that starts with, what have you done that qualifies you to do what we need to do? And have it go through kind of a multi-time base. Well, I learned this at this place. I learned this at this place. I learned that at that place. This is how I like to work. This is how I don't like to work. This is who I am. And the key difference here, it will actually, in fact, read very much like a resume. But the key difference here is that it doesn't expect that complex tasks and complex skills are the product of linear time. But I think a lot of these sort of conventions and conventional thinking and the sort of denigration of security. And when I talk about the denigration of security, I'm talking about things like, you know, when I talk to an attorney and they say, oh, don't email me something because it's not secure, it's not safe. And there's an irony there, which is that I believe the largest security hole in email is that back in the day, the internet was not all one place. And so there was a protocol within email where you can send email to a server that sends it to another server that sends it to another server. Because if you're not connected to the entire internet, that was actually required. And the fact that that protocol is still there is one of the reasons why security experts say, oh, well, you know, email's not secure because you never know which server it's going to be on. I've written and launched a few different email servers over the years, and I have absolutely never seen emails that don't come directly from the sending server. And this comes down to a convention that has not really been investigated. And so we have things like, you know, what I just mentioned, which was an attorney says, oh, don't email, you have to use my website. Oh, you have to change your password, and then that results in, you know, writing sticky notes down. And I think the answer to these things, as is the answer to a lot of employment problems, is looking at the conventions that are used and finding out if they have a real traditional value, such as, I need to know that when I get home, I can use my keys to get in my front door. I don't want to change that convention, right? That's a good convention. Versus, is there a way to give the same personal connection that passwords have to asymmetric and private keys? And is there a way to use, you know, a skills document versus a resume to identify who has the skills in a world that has a way of having a very significant gap between the development of skills and the sort of expected conventional titles of a position? And I think that there absolutely is possibility there. And if you haven't seen The Light We Cannot See on Netflix, I highly encourage you to check it out and think about, if you want, if I can give you homework here, if you're watching that show, think about the idea of privacy, safety, and security, and the idea that reading a book out of order was all it took to provide the information in plain sight, undetectable to the Allied forces in World War II. And so the question of how we can solve tasks in our life pragmatically and simplistically can often be connected to things that matter to us and are far more applicable than it seems, given all the complexity in the world. Stay tuned for what we're doing at Compare Basic with Seriously Human, a new hiring format, and PhraseKey, which we hope solves a lot of the security problems around the improvements that we would like to see from passwords.